Backseat Producers, episode 212, Reservoir Dogs.
Hey, this is Tony.
Hey, this is Daryl.
This is Jill.
This is David.
And this is Charles.
And we are the Backseat Producers. Welcome, Charles.
Good to be here.
Why are you here?
I'm Jill's son, and I'm on Christmas break. I really like this movie, so I decided to come.
Excellent. Excellent.
By the way, Tony, whenever I go places and talk about doing a movie review podcast, I invite whomever I'm talking to at the time out to record.
That's fine.
Every single person I talk to asks me. I was at a client site and somebody asked me about it and I invited them. Although I don't actually want them to show up.
That'll be awkward.
Kinda.
It'll be more awkward if they listen.
He also shaves his arms and legs and does not swim.
Is he a cyclist?
Yes. That's weird.
No, it's actually pretty common.
Yeah, but he's not cycling right now.
Oh.
I can almost guarantee you he's not cycling right now because it's freezing.
That's the best time to go.
Somebody almost killed me today! Speaking of, it's the best time to go. So there's this one, like, 90-degree turn, but there's no stop sign or a light. It was completely iced over, and this truck turned it, but didn't stop going the direction of me, and I was like, oh, shit.
But not on a bike, though.
Not on a bike, no. Okay. It was a huge truck. And the tiny Asian woman inside recovered at the last possible second. It was awesome. Then I slid through it. That was less awesome. Because then I was in a graveyard. My commute to work is like 5 minutes, but it's a perilous 5 minutes.
It was harrowing 5 minutes of your life.
I don't have to worry about commuting this week.
Is it because the botanical garden is fascist and you're off?
No, it's just because I'm off. I've taken the week off.
You know,
you've been off for some time.
Oh, you took this week off? Oh,
yeah.
It's the easy week at work. No one expects you to do anything.
Somebody has to be here for the kids. So. Hey, plus, it's cool to just hang out with them.
It's the holidays.
Yeah, that didn't work last week.
I'm doing it
right now. Sucked.
Yeah, you gotta play a little bit of the religion card. I don't know if you know, but Christ's birth is this weekend, so...
No.
Guarantee you will get zero follow-up questions.
Not there.
That's weird.
Not really.
It should make them feel more uncomfortable. Huge gold cross.
That would. That would probably make people feel more uncomfortable.
Alright, so... Next week, Misery?
Misery. I completely forgot... up to yesterday what we were talking about this week.
What?
I just blanked. My
well,
memory just was gone.
Last week.
And all weekend. Yeah, because once I got Arkham City, I kind of got this drive to clean up.
Batman.
Yeah, you got to clean up the city.
Yeah.
It's a wretched hive of scum and villainy.
It is a wretched hive of scum and villainy.
And somebody's got to do it.
So might as well be me, the goddamn Batman.
Yeah.
That's right.
And the best part of Arkham City is when you start playing, you feel like Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no building up to being Batman. You're Batman.
You're just Batman, immediately. Yep. As Bruce Wayne, kicking people's ass with your hands
tied.
That
was awesome. In a suit. All right, so let's talk about Reservoir Dogs, Tony. Let's get this going.
High level. What do you think?
It's Reservoir Dogs. Come on.
All right. So are we, like, all in agreement about that? Or is there any dissension?
I'll have some dissension. I didn't think this movie held up on the second viewing after
Get Sunday. Out.
Really? See, I actually found it more interesting after... I mean, I hadn't seen this as original, and then you pick up on a lot more of the subtleties of the movie, which is really cool.
Especially after every other movie after this has been picking pieces of it out of there.
Yeah, when I saw this movie and I liked it, I didn't know why I liked it, but having rewatched it yesterday, I can more clearly define what it is about the movie I like. So, it was a much better viewing the second time around than it was the first time. Of course, it was also more painful to get through. Because there are scenes that drag on forever, and there's, like, almost no action in this movie.
That's the point.
Mm-hmm. I know. Well, I get that that's a point, but that still doesn't make the dialogue any easier to get through.
Oh, I love the dialogue, though. It's very David Mamet, and at the time, that was kind of cutting edge. I think it's great.
The dialogue's great, but this movie is the foreplay for going to bed early. Seriously, you hear all about this stuff that's going to happen, or has happened, and then you never see any of it.
There's still some scenes that are pretty action-packed.
Yeah, well, I mean, the torture scene is pretty awesome, but...
Well, that's kind of a trademark Tarantino scene, is, you know, you have this long, boom! You have the action all happens all at once.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also a nice budget saver.
Oh, no, well, that too.
Hey,
but the audience,
this guy just plugged 20 guys. But also, you let the
audience kind of figure out what's going on, because they're going to figure out a lot more detail.
Well, and it wasn't about the heist.
Right.
Yeah, well, I know.
And that's why they did. I mean, there was basically two reasons they didn't include the heist. One, yes, budget. Because originally this movie was slotted for a $30,000 budget.
Yeah. Until Harvey Keitel.
And then Harvey Keitel backed it and it got up to $1.5 million, which is still a ridiculously small budget.
Yep. Even for a movie at that era.
But, and I mean, two,
it
doesn't...
made it pack.
It doesn't...
Yeah.
The heist doesn't matter. What happens...
Right, and second,
matter.
The heist doesn't matter. It is not about the heist.
Right.
It's character study of who these people are.
Ooh, I disagree.
All right.
I think this entire movie is structured to explore traditional and non-traditional storytelling techniques.
I don't know. That's
because he tells you and never shows you, and then later he turns it on his head and, like, he tells you and then inserts the dude into the story to show you. The whole thing is structured around this. Okay, so there's the central thing that you don't even see, but you see all the pieces around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just get little glimpses into it. But it tells a pretty complete story in the middle. Like, from the context of everything that everybody says, you know exactly what happened. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so they flash back to Tim Roth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Orange.
Yeah, so he's sitting in the diner, and he's talking to the guy, and the guy's like, hey, did you use my bathroom story? I don't know what he calls it. He called it something.
The commode story.
There it is, the commode story. Did you use my commode story? So then they flash back again to him talking about it, and then they just insert Tim Roth into it. So they start telling you about it, and then he changes the way that he's telling the story by, instead of telling you about it, shows you the scene that happens. But the hilarious thing about that is that scene never happens. It's a completely fabricated story. So he's showing you action that never happens, but not showing you action that does happen.
Which is why I think character building.
Yeah, I think that's more just to avoid having guys telling the story, because that would be all it would be.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, the story's pretty boring.
Yeah,
if you just see what happens, it's a 10-minute movie then.
Right.
Oh, I love the relationship between Mr. White and Mr. Orange throughout the film. I actually thought that was more interesting to me than any of the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that Tim Roth's accent is horrible.
Well, that's why. Did you read the woman who shoots and kills him?
Yeah, it's his speech coach.
It's his diction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was the one who suggested that she needed to take the part because she was killing him already.
That's fantastic.
And, yeah, I mean, well, and it got worse when he, in some of the more, when he's screaming in agony, but I love the parent-child play throughout the scenes and how he's kicking the car seat, but luckily didn't have to deal with the baby issue. He treats the gun like a rattle.
Mm-hmm.
He's writhing around in pain. Harvey Keitel singing basically to him. I mean, it was really a neat kind of way to lay out that relationship and to then further explain Mr. White's actions later on.
Well, it also explained how Mr. Orange could be the cop when he was one that was shot, because the implication all the way up until they actually show him getting shot is that he was shot during the heist.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you don't realize until later that that wasn't how it happened, that it was an accident, yeah, really, that because the cops wouldn't have shot him.
Yep.
So you get the idea that, yeah, maybe he's really not the cop until you see that scene getting shot.
Well, except for the foreshadowing, the original establishment scene in the diner kind of makes it. I mean, he's the one who gives away the...
rats out, Mr. Prank.
Yeah. To Joe. But even that, like, Mr. White was my favorite character in this, but I love Harvey Keitel too, but even, like, that establishment scene of all of those guys talking about Madonna is probably one of my favorite scenes in a movie of all time. Because of...
Because just, it's hilarious?
But also it establishes things like the Mr. White challenging Joe foreshadows what's going to be happening later on.
Right.
Mr. Orange letting Joe know that Mr. Pink is the one who's not willing to
it also establishes
so much in that one scene is amazing.
Yeah, it establishes Mr. Pink is the one who he's got his own mind made up. He has his way of doing things that he's inflexible on.
Yeah. Well, and you know, in that establishment scene too, with the only other than Joe, the only guy who doesn't have a color name is the one wearing the color tracksuit, and that's nice guy.
You mean Jonah Hill?
Yeah. Well, that's...
Actually, that's his own tracksuit.
Yeah.
But you did... Charles said that when we were watching it, that he sounded just like Jonah Hill.
Looks like him, too.
Well, and let's go back to the only one without a color name. So is blonde considered a color, then?
Yes.
Because I thought it interesting... it's a hair color, but the rest of them were all normal
primary
colors.
Color,
yeah.
I thought that difference was interesting.
Well, I couldn't call him Mr. Yellow, because yellow has connotations of...
He could have been Mr. Black. I mean, he was kind of crazy and psychopathic.
But that's why Joe didn't want... He wanted to give out the name so they wouldn't sit there and just argue over who was going to have the cooler color. And what did they do? They argue over who's the cooler color.
But you didn't want the colors to completely give away the character, because mm-hmm. that would have been too easy.
God damn, I love Steve Buscemi. I'm just going to come out and say it. That dude is awesome. The best scene in this movie with Steve Buscemi is that really tense, everyone's got a gun trained on everybody else. Everybody shoots, and then he crawls out from underneath the ramp.
Yeah.
God, I love that.
Well, and he's the only one that lives, because if you hear at the end, he gets arrested.
No.
We had to go back. We actually went back and watched that scene to listen for all of that, because you get so focused in on
the
conflict.
Dialogue, yeah.
Well, and the conflict between White and Orange that you don't even... I mean, you hear it, but you don't really pay attention to it. Although I couldn't help but think of you, David, when Mr. Pink is explaining why he doesn't tip. It struck me as the kind of logic you would use in an argument.
I tip, but... I agree with him.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be automatic, but I do it anyway.
Yeah.
See, and that's why I liked watching it a second time better than the first time, because you knew the whole plot line and everything, so you were able to pay attention to more of those minute details.
Yeah, like, a lot of those gotchas.
It's in a mortuary the entire time, which I didn't realize the first time around.
Yeah, Mr. Blonde's sitting on a hearse. Yeah.
And then when they go into like the kitchen area, Mr. Pink and Mr. White, there's like places for cleaning out bodies and like the little white coats, and I missed that the first time through I watched it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I even thought that was interesting treatment too. Is, you know, the parents go off in the other room so not to, you know, for the child to hear them arguing.
Right.
I thought was kind of a classic. It was great. I mean, there's so many different levels.
Yeah, and I love Tarantino's style. I like the way that he does violence. I like the way that he does dialogue. I mean, right before we watched this, we watched Plinkett's reviews of Star Wars Episode I, where he's talking about flat. Have you seen those?
Mm-mm.
I'll send you the link. They're awesome. He's talking about the flat angles that Star Wars is shot in, where like almost every scene of dialogue is someone sitting on a couch. A-B shots just back and forth on their faces and how boring it is to watch. Well, I mean, even just the opening scene where they're sitting around the table, there are like almost half the shots where people are talking, you don't even see the person talking.
Yeah.
Like it's either behind someone or like in the
and the camera's angle is constantly moving around.
Yeah, the camera's always
it's weirdly positioned. Dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's intended to offset you from what's going on. Like you see Mr. White talking to Mr. Pink, but like it's not the hallway and you don't even see Mr. Pink. You can't
You just have the rotation of the camera around each of the characters, not cut shots of them talking back and forth.
Well, in that scene, you can't see what Mr. Pink's doing, but you can hear all the stuff he's doing. Like, he's smashing things and kicking things around. And, I mean, that adds so much to it, too.
Yeah, and it feels dirty, which is what I love about Tarantino's style, is that it feels off, but it feels natural.
Yeah.
Like, it feels dingy.
Well, so much of what he did in this movie also reminds me of a play, you know, theater. Mm-hmm. More so than cinema.
Yeah, I mean, because
there's
an extremely minimalist, like, movie prop feel to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing to interact with in the mortuary. Almost everything that happens is them walking around and pacing and like, set direction.
It becomes the dialogue, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the fact that they didn't use an orchestra score and chose music makes it more interesting. Because then the music and the song choices also become part of the character.
One thing that struck me, like the opening scene where there are seven or eight people around the table.
I think eight.
Eight.
Six colors.
Guys.
Right, six colors, Eddie and Joe.
Yeah.
All of them had dialogue throughout that sequence. And that is very unusual in film. To have that many people with speaking lines in one scene without someone leaving the scene, without people coming into the scene. If you watch a lot, you've been watching a lot of How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
All right. They have six primary characters. Five primary characters. But you very seldom see all five of them in scene together without a couple of characters being distracted to the point of not being part of the main conversation, or just sitting there watching.
Right, and they get up and go get beer and stuff like that.
Right.
They do a whole bunch of tricks to keep the conversation to at least, or to at most, three people.
To at most three people. And that's pretty common in a lot of script. And I thought it was really bold for the first scene in his first movie to have eight speaking characters rotating around the table and have it be one fluid conversation.
But yet a little chaotic.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what it is. Where you feel a little unsettled throughout the whole movie because it's just a little bit chaotic, which fits, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how you should experience it.
Yeah,
it's good because it builds that, and I don't want to use the word tension, but it puts you on the edge of your seat because it's like you have to strain to hear what they're saying because the shots where you can't see the person talking are muffled because you can't, like, the sound's not hitting the microphone in the right way. Because there's a person in between it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels muffled, and so you're like, you're intently listening to what they're saying, and that's a clever device to force you to pay attention to what they're getting.
It almost builds a little bit of a paranoia, too, which adds to the to the whole theme of the film.
Well, and going off the paranoia point, so the whole thing driving the film really is them trying to figure out who the rat is, and I think the paranoia, them not knowing each other's names and not knowing anything about each other builds that even more. I mean, I know it was designed so that they don't know anything, so if they get caught, they can't rat each other out, but it leads to even more distrust, because they've got no connections with each other.
Well, some of the characters do have connections to each other, but the problem is they don't, and others don't.
But so with Mr. White, when Mr. Orange, he thinks Mr. Orange is dying, he tells him his name to make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, but we do know there's a connection between Joe... A nice guy, Eddie, and Mr. Blonde.
Eddie's his son. He calls him daddy through the whole thing.
Yeah, but he also knows Mr. Blonde really well, too, because he did time for them.
Yeah, but the rest of the crew didn't even know that connection existed until the standoff.
Mr. White knows that Eddie and Joe.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that Mr. Blonde has that relationship with them.
Right.
I'm saying the crew, all the misters, they have no clue who each other are.
Right.
They don't know any of their connections with Joe or Nice Guy Eddie.
Except by reputation.
they don't even know each other's reputation, though.
Yep.
They know nothing about each other.
Well, they know they're all criminals, so they have to have some sort of knowledge of their some of their background. You know,
but they don't, though. I mean, other than they know that they trust Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe's missing for almost the entire film.
They
keep saying, "Where's Joe?"
But we know he's on the way after we meet up with Eddie. That's, again, you're right in the terms of, again, they're all start pointing fingers at each other immediately when everything goes wrong. Like, they had no plan B. They just thought they were going to just walk in, do this thing, and walk out, and it all went wrong.
And I think this is one of the first movies out that somebody actually mimics David Mamet's dialogue style too, which I thought was interesting. Like, I'm even looking at some of the quotes out of here, and, you know, the wordplay and the emphasis.
Well, just give us an example. What's Mamet's special signature?
Well, one, vulgarity.
Okay.
I mean,
272 fucks.
Yeah.
All right.
But then also, he will emphasize keywords, and it's kind of like an odd rhythm to it. You see it, like, Glengarry Glen Ross is probably the perfect example, but a lot of it is really taking language down to its, almost, I don't want to say dirtiest, but grittiest form.
Most common vulgar.
Yeah, yeah, I mean.
It's what happens when people get suddenly real with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
All the niceties and the civility disappear.
You know, but some of the line, like that entry, has tons of just witty, sharp, hysterical.
Yeah, the whole Madonna bit is really funny. Since I've never heard the song they're talking about, I assume that's also funny, but...
Which song?
They're talking about a couple of them.
Yeah.
They talk about...
the beginning?
Yeah.
Like
True
a Virgin?
Blue. True Blue.
Papa Don't Preach.
Like a Virgin.
But they're talking about how Like a Virgin... Yeah. That was the main one that they were discussing.
Before that, they were talking about a couple other ones, though.
Yeah, they mentioned True Blue... And did they mention Papa Don't Preach?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got it right here.
Okay. I just didn't remember.
Well, because I Mr. Blue said, I like her early stuff, you know, Lucky Star, Borderline, but when she got into Papa Don't Preach phase, I don't know, I turned out to doubt. Well, I even like the juxtaposition between Mr. Orange talking to that fellow cop in the scene you talked about and describing the thing. And then you cut to him in his apartment. And
he's got a Silver Surfer.
Well, you've got the posters, but then also you have the action figures. I mean, he knocks over the one.
Yeah.
I mean, so you get these parallels that are just, it's well done. I don't think there's a lot of directors who pay that kind of attention to those little
interesting aspect of him as he's getting ready to walk out to meet up with the crew. He has to stand in front of the mirror and kind of do a self-affirmation that he's a badass.
Yeah.
He's a little insecure on that. And then as he's walking to meet up with the crew, the undercover cops who are watching him are commenting, you gotta have a head full of rocks to do undercover work. So at one point he's trying to build himself up, and in another scene they're tearing him back down.
Well, but it also then it plays out when he's shot and he's screaming, and then finally he's telling Mr. White, I've got my senses now, and then proceeds to say, I think you need to drop me off at the hospital. I mean, so it parallels later on how he behaves in a crisis.
He tends to fall apart.
Yeah, exactly. You know, screaming like a baby. I mean,
well, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, but that scene with him in the bathroom as he's telling the story to other people, I really like the parallelism with that, because he's telling a story about him trying to play cool and not be found out by those cops in the bathroom when he's telling a story trying not to be found out by the guys he's trying to sell himself to. So I really like that parallelism.
Yeah. And that's why I love that when they suspend the current story, go into the flashback, then they go into the fantasy of the story he's going to tell, and then they go to a different flashback of him actually telling the story.
Yeah.
It's like four layers, and then they backtrack all the way back.
It's Inception.
Yeah, it's Inception. It's great.
And that story that the cops are telling in that story is about somebody reaching into their glove compartment, which Mr. Orange is killed by a woman who pulls a gun out of the glove compartment. More layers.
That's good. I didn't catch that.
I didn't either.
If you pay attention to his own story.
That's good. God damn, I love Steve Buscemi.
I can't get
over it, Tony.
Of the eight leads, of those eight guys sitting around the table at the beginning of the movie, four of them are dead.
Not Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
Wow.
Chris Penn,
Harvey Keitel.
And Bunker.
Joe and Ed Bunker. Eddie Bunker and the guy who played Joe Cabot, all of them are gone.
Wow.
I bet it's Tarantino killing them. Solve the mystery.
Yep.
It's new documentary. He's pretty, he's having a hard time getting Buscemi to agree.
Danny Trejo is actually doing the killing, but Tarantino's filming it. New movie, Machete 2.
Oh. So the tagline, this was like five strangers, blah, 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 blah. And then they say several times in the movie they mention five people, but there's actually six colors. And I'm wondering if it was because Quentin Tarantino originally was going to play Mr. Pink himself, but Steve Buscemi blew him away, so he gave that to him. So he was just like, screw it, I'll add another character in this beginning scene, we'll deal with it.
Yeah, this is shit, so I'm going to be Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
Yep.
Either that, or when they mention you're going to be with five, did he say with five other guys, or is it going to be?
Well, what was the tagline?
It's five strangers.
Tagline: five strangers.
And then whenever he said it's a five-man crew. I know what you're talking about. I thought he said it is a five-man crew.
Yeah, it's a five. There's going to be five of you wondering who the rat is. So the sixth guy will know who the rat is because he's the rat. So I don't know if that's
the part.
Because I thought about that too. Because when he said that, I was thinking.
There really are only five strangers, because no matter whose point you're looking at it, that's the most strangers you're ever going to get.
Right. Yeah,
but I don't think that probably was not intentional.
And now I want to go figure out what Joe says to Mr. White when he's explaining the jocks. I thought he said it's a five-man crew, but I'm wondering if he said you'll be with, I don't know how he would have phrased it, but could have phrased it differently.
So I dug this movie, Tony.
It was a good movie.
Yep.
I don't think it's his best.
Considering it's his first, it usually isn't.
Well, yeah, but
it was groundbreaking for its time.
Hey, I mean,
it still is pretty groundbreaking in most cases.
M. Night Shyamalan, I think his best is his first is his best. So I don't think that's really a rule that you can.
Wait. What did you just say?
His first is his
M. Night Shyamalan's first movie is his best movie to date.
All right. I think this is better than Pulp Fiction, and I can't think of a movie that he's done that I like better than Pulp Fiction.
I actually enjoy Pulp Fiction more than this.
I know.
Yeah, this is my favorite.
This is better than Pulp Fiction.
I know that in this movie, every other director has just pulled everything from it. Every time we see a scene where we got a bunch of guys walking down the aisle, street, road, it's always is a slow motion as is
coupling.
A group.
Coupling. I knew that's what you were thinking. There's this scene in Coupling where they're going to a funeral and the guys are all dressed in suits and they're walking really slow along a brick wall and the girls are like, "Would you guys stop playing Reservoir Dogs?"
It's not slowed down. They're just walking.
They're just it's not slowed down. They're just walking.
Just walking
slow.
That way.
Because then they stop and they turn and they walk normal speed across the street.
God damn, Coupling is so good.
The sequence in the torture scene where he's playing
Stuck in the Middle with You.
Stuck in the Middle with You.
Yeah, I cannot listen to that song anymore.
Reminds
it
me.
Ruined it for me.
It reminds me a lot of the scene in Boogie Nights with Sister Christian.
Mark
Wahlberg. Where he was shooting the place up. What's his name? Was shooting the place up to Sister Christian. Mark Wahlberg was in that.
Yes, in Boogie Nights.
He was in Boogie Nights.
I'm trying to remember when there was any gunfire in that.
In the fancy house.
Yeah.
And the guy like pulls out a gun to and it's Sister Christian's playing on the radio and he just starts shooting the place up.
It did not remind me of that, but mostly because I've not seen Boogie Nights, so.
And that just kind of goes to that was probably lifted. That same kind of feel was lifted for that scene in that movie.
Actually, apparently Quentin Tarantino has had a bigger influence on other directors, probably more so than he should have, because of this movie and his subsequent movies.
Well, but he was influenced by directors too. I mean, he talks about the homage to all of these different movies that he was accused of plagiarizing for this movie.
Right. But he's kind of really fascinated with the grindhouse era of movies. The schlock he put together slapdash films.
Oh, I don't know about. I don't know if I agree with that, but
yeah,
he has produced like what, three of the Grindhouse movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but early on, I don't. I'm like this one. I don't.
Machete.
Think
machete.
That's...
Machete.
And there's another one too. I think.
Man, Machete was.
I didn't watch that one after I watched Death Proof and whatever the double feature one.
I watched Planet Terror. I didn't watch Death Proof.
Oh.
I like Death Proof. I liked it for what it was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but it just like with Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, the stories are so much better crafted, I think, than
Grindhouse is going for a very specific feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it feels ridiculous, and
that's what it's supposed to do.
I think Reservoir Dogs isn't ridiculous, though. I think it's well told.
You can't compare them.
No, I realize that, but I'm saying that I prefer this style to the other one.
Oh, yeah.
Because I prefer the story.
I like how the violence is very quick and brutal. And, I mean, that's just his style.
That's one of his signature moves.
Well, it's also kind of the way violence is. Violence doesn't tend to be drawn out. It's very quick. It's hard. It's bloody. It's not pretty. I mean, that's the way it was in Pulp Fiction. They're jacking around and boom! Yeah.
Yeah, like when John Travolta comes out of the bathroom and gets killed with some gun.
Yeah.
They're doing a Kill Bill Volume 3?
They are. I thought,
news to me.
Mm. Out 2014, according to...
2014, come on! We can put this on the books, but I can't get my goddamn Dark Tower movie made.
The sequence... There was that scene in... Boondock Saints, where
Tony,
she's
the
cat.
Talk about that movie.
That movie was terrible.
We don't talk about that movie, Tony.
No. But there was the scene where he shoots the cat.
Yep.
That reminded me a lot of the scene in Pulp Fiction, where he was in the backseat of the car and the gun goes off.
That's why you watch where you point your guns.
Yeah.
This is like a weird 90s thing where they call the guy a cat. You know, I don't know where I'm going with that.
I find your
episode 3 cup offensive, though.
I thought it was interesting that they some of the write-ups they mentioned about the lack of women in the movie, but I actually like that there are no women in the movie. They talk about it, they reference Pam Grier, and so you get that sexual tension. They talk about the waitress, but yet you never really, she never really engages the viewer.
There's no speaking parts?
But I like that. I think that if they had actually had the female cop, it would have
been
distracting, and it wouldn't really have meant anything. I don't think
and a woman
a
is who kills Mr. Orange.
No.
Shoots him.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. I mean, I guess Mr. White technically kills Mr. Orange, but...
That kind of foils your father-son moment.
No, because essentially Mr. White sacrificed himself for Mr. Orange. He kills two of his friends for Mr. Orange.
Oh, yeah, by the way, I'm a cop.
And what does he do? Yeah. He shoots him.
Well,
so this is what confuses me. Why does he tell him
at that point?
Because Joe's dead. He doesn't have to, I mean, and he knows he's dying. And
everyone's dying.
He doesn't have any allegiance to his job anymore. This guy just, gave up everything for him. Yeah.
Was he really going to die, though? He bled there for
In the belly, he would have been dead long before that movie had finished if it was real.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, though. He wasn't, so... I got the impression that he was going to be fine as long as they got him a doctor in the next hour or two. Although, they don't do anything to stop the bleeding, which is confusing to me.
No, and they
undo the
belt, which is even worse.
Yeah. So there's just... so much blood.
But there are things like, I love Harvey Keitel combing his hair. I mean, just doing those kind of paternal things and, in a crisis, those instinctual things.
Parenting,
Yeah.
When, as you said, Mr. Pink and Mr. White going and having the mom-dad conversation in the kitchen...
Steve Buscemi is the woman in this movie.
That's why it's Mr. Pink.
Exactly. He's the rational one.
He's the rational one. He's the one hiding underneath the ramp during the violence.
I'm convinced that his tip thing in the beginning is only to establish that when he says we were set up, that you don't think that he's full of shit.
Well, and it establishes the foreshadow of Mr. Orange being the rat.
Well, and it's a juxtaposition to all of the sexist stuff they talk about in the car later on, too. Mm. I mean, so I kind of... And well, even in previous part of the conversation was all about sex and women liking big dicks and stuff. And then they start talking about women trying to make a living, and all of a sudden these guys are... You know, stepping up for women's rights and equality, kind of thing, and you know, so it's that constant tension.
Did you read the trivia for the movie on IMDb?
I did not.
Tony, how do you never read the stuff before the movie?
I was watching the movie instead.
Tony, it's hysterical. So, his face? God damn it, Eddie.
Nice guy, Eddie.
Yeah, what's his real name though?
Chris Penn.
So what's his brother was married to Madonna at the time, which is why he doesn't take part in the conversation. And after the movie, Madonna loved the movie, and so she sent Quentin Tarantino a signed album of hers that says, "It's not about the dick, but the song is about love."
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So I thought Harvey Keitel was dead.
He's not.
Who am I thinking of?
He isn't dead.
No, but apparently he's not. I misspoke earlier.
You're thinking of... Damn, what we talked about.
Is Bunker Blue? Is Mr. Blue Bunker?
Blue is Bunker, yes. Yeah. He is dead.
You think Paul Newman?
No.
No.
I thought Harvey Keitel had died.
You're thinking about the smoking man from X-Files.
I don't know who that is.
What?
I never watched X-Files.
Dennis Hopper.
No, I wasn't thinking about Dennis Hopper either.
Oh, he was King Koopa.
But he did die.
I mean, he's kind of that same... He's in that same family of actors.
Oh, he was in Waterworld.
Yes, he was.
I used to think like one of his worst movies.
That's a great movie.
That movie's awesome.
It's a great movie.
Oh, it's horrible.
What?
And way too long.
Maybe you were watching the Postman instead. Because it's kind of the same deal.
It is kind of the same. Just one's aquatically based.
Yeah. One's male based.
Yeah. One's postal based.
Yeah. And then look what happened. Post office is bankrupt. Kevin Costner saw it coming.
Yeah, but the first thing to come back will be the post office.
I hope not. I hate the post office. I stepped away, so I don't know. Did somebody say Harvey Keitel was dead? It's pretty good stuff, Tony. Tony, who's this movie for?
Grown Ups.
You didn't watch this with Holden?
No.
No.
I made him leave the house.
Under 21 seems like a missed opportunity. He learned the facts of life.
Yeah.
Actually, we don't really want to watch it without the 272 F-bombs.
It's like a crash course. Like, after that, you know how to use it.
Well, really, if anyone who watches this movie will not be offended by that word anymore.
No.
Little lost his meaning.
Yeah.
Melina made the mistake of telling me once that she was offended by my use of the C-bomb. So from that point on, nonstop.
Desensitized.
Booyah.
I was just thinking, because I was looking at the cast list, I even loved like having Stephen Wright be the DJ.
The DJ. I mean, and then you never see him.
Well, no, you don't need to, because his voice is so distinctive. But it was like just one of those little touches that you just go, yeah, that's perfect.
Of anybody to do a 70s DJ.
I don't even know who this person is.
He's a comedian.
Noted for his rather slow, monotone, but he delivers these rather deep thought type things.
Well, and quite action-packed punches, but yet in a very flat, almost like you're listening to, who is that teacher in...
Ben Stiller?
Ben Stein.
But was he as funny as... Damn it. He's dead. He was really funny.
George Carlin?
No. George Carlin was really funny. The other one. The other comedian who was really funny. God, Damn it.
There's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny comedians.
I know.
There's a lot of funny comedians that are dead.
That are dead.
I mean, yeah, they had a real distinctive style of speech.
Well, that's sort of the part there.
I went to the store to buy a candle holder, but they were out. So I got a cake. Damn it. Love escalators, man. Escalators can never be broken. They can only be stairs. Escalator temporarily stairs. Damn it.
These are his
chat room, help me out here. Look this shit up. I know I got I have material of his.
Mitch
Hedberg. There it is, Mitch Hedberg. Perfect. Don't. Just don't.
It's his line. You can't steal it.
Don't. Even if you don't know who it is, I don't want to hear it.
Do it.
I just don't want to.
I have some of my time.
What? I have some of his material, I think, and we'll listen to it. Don't think we won't.
Be a long drive home.
Yeah, it's gonna be a long drive home. I'm looking to see if I got it. Feel free to continue without me, gentlemen and Jill.
I'm just laughing.
I don't really have a whole lot else.
The only thing I can think of is the, I like the connections when I was reading the statistics or the fun trivia about this was that, so Mr. White, you have that conversation with him and Joe about Alabama, his partner.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be Alabama from True Romance. And
oh wow,
Vic Vega is supposed to be
and Vince Vega
from John Travolta from
Pulp Fiction.
And Mr. Blonde, they're brothers. And Quentin Tarantino originally had planned to make a movie called Double V in Vegas or Double V Vegas, in which John Travolta and Mr. Blonde were in it together as brothers.
Oh, that would have been nice.
But they got too old before he could pull it off.
Yeah.
And he was originally going to write in Mr. White at the end of True Romance. But he ended up changing.
Oh, wow.
Well, they were going to have her meeting him.
So, more reasons why I like this movie over his Grindhouse.
I forgot all that Michael Madsen was in Donnie Brasco.
Man, where would we be with an IMDb? Because they were having that conversation in the car about who played that chick on the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, just look it up on IMDb. Oh, wait.
On your iPhone.
Oh, wait, that's not that.
I was thinking that they could not have that scene take place in a modern movie because somebody would have had to have looked it up.
Just opened their phone and looked up. Yeah, it was like.
Then I can include it. He manages to pull out fine, but it takes a while to say something. And I really like the.
And he takes the edge off the whole thing.
Yeah.
That was a good scene. It was a bad scene. That guy.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you do. I've heard stories about you, Tony.
I don't know who would be telling him.
Me. Mostly, I told myself stories about you that I made up.
That's
but
fair.
But I believed every word. Every word.
That sounds like paranoia.
Nope.
Sounds bipolar like, disorder.
Sounds like a revelation.
Revelations?
So you're a prophet?
Kinda. All right, I got nothing else here.
I think we're done.
All right. Next week we are going to discuss Misery.
Yeah.
For all you Stephen King fans.
No, mostly just for people that sit across from that guy.
Yeah, that's true misery.
Kathy Bates doesn't get naked in this one.
Thank God.
Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
It would improve the movie.
The boner shrinker. Oh, what are you doing, Daryl?
That would have made it even more.
Now I planted that image in his mind. He's in a bad time.
Made it even more horrific.
No. I went to an all-male high school, Daryl. I've got this.
You have my sympathies.
I've developed a skill by which, once people say things, I don't immediately visualize it, and it helps me a lot. Especially when my mom or Melina tells me sex stories about my parents. Not interesting.
No, it's true. You build up those skills to block those out.
Yep.
I'm on like 7 years now of all high school.
Not technically.
Pretty much.
The ratio is terribly skewed.
Yes, it is.
And, really? At West Point? You don't say. All right, Tony. All right. I see you trying to keep me here.
No, leave.
Tony, I wish you wouldn't try and get me drunk on these Wednesdays.
There's some booze in there.
He's got the ice rocks.
He's got two.
I do, and those should be nice and cold now. I don't trust it. Now. Prepared.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you next week.
All right,
carrying a flask would be awkward carrying a flask of Bud Light.
You need a really big flask.
Yeah.
People would take a swig and like, what is this? Bud Light.
Did you pee in here?
That's what I would say.
Flat Bud Light? It wasn't flat when I put it in.